Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
All week, we have been on indictment watch, wondering if the case about President Trump allegedly paying hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels will result in the first indictment of a former U.S. president in American history. Today, we got two pieces of news that sort of made me wonder if there is now competition for that historic first. Two pieces of news that made me wonder which case against Trump will go down in history as the first criminal case brought against a former president. The first piece of news was that Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who is overseeing the Stormy Daniels case, he postponed a scheduled grand jury session today. We don't know why he did that, and we will get some expert legal help breaking that down later this hour. But for now, the bottom line is no indictment in that case is happening today. That is number one. Number two has to do with special counsel Jack Smith's investigation into whether Trump took classified documents with him when he left the White House and whether Trump obstructed justice when the government tried to get those documents back. Now, we got such a huge advance in that case today. It has me wondering how close special counsel Smith may be to an indictment of his very own. Is there the shred of a chance that Jack Smith makes history first? Last night, the appeals court in D.C. gave Trump's legal team until midnight to file a brief in the Mar-a-Lago case. And after that, special counsel Smith's team had until 6 a.m. to file its response. They literally had to pull an all-nighter. So what is so important that the Court of Appeals in D.C. decided it could not even wait one day and instead needed Jack Smith's team to stay up all night? This is Trump attorney Evan Corcoran. He is not only representing President Trump now, but he has also been Trump's primary point of contact with the National Archives and the DOJ for nearly a year now. And because a ton of this case seems to be about Trump's potential obstruction of justice, Evan Corcoran being Trump's lawyer since April of 2022, that is all very, very relevant here. You might remember that back in June of last year, 2 months prior to the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago, Trump's lawyers gave a statement to the Department of Justice saying that a diligent search had been conducted, and to the best of their knowledge, all classified material at the property had been returned. Evan Corcoran drafted that statement, and another Trump lawyer signed it. And then, 2 months later, the FBI found more than 100 classified documents in a storage area and in Trump's own office, in his family's personal residence at Mar-a-Lago. Now, a key part of this investigation is how those documents got into Trump's residence in the very first place, and whether Trump moving them there may have been an attempt to obstruct justice. The Washington Post reported last year that the Department of Justice had gathered evidence indicating that Trump told people to move boxes to his residence after his legal team had received a subpoena for Mar-a-Lago security camera footage. Once the DOJ got its hands on that footage, it allegedly showed exactly that, people moving boxes to Trump's personal residence shortly after his legal team learned of the subpoena. And when I say Trump's legal team here, again, the point person on the legal team is Evan Corcoran. So again, back to the key part of this investigation. Was the moving of those boxes an attempt to obstruct justice? With that in mind, one of the things the special counsel is reportedly particularly interested in is a phone call between Trump and Evan Corcoran right around the time the subpoena for that video footage was first issued, maybe to find out what Evan Corcoran was being told or not told about those boxes. So all of this puts Trump lawyer Evan Corcoran in a very unique position. Yes, he's Trump's lawyer, but he might also be a witness to or party to a crime. He might be wittingly or unwittingly a pawn in President Trump's alleged obstruction of justice. And that, something known as the crime fraud exception, that can break attorney-client privilege. Last month, special counsel Jack Smith asked a D.C. District Court judge for approval to do just that, approval to force Corcoran to cooperate with this investigation. ABC News reported that the special counsel presented evidence that Trump, quote, deliberately misled his own attorneys and evidence that appears to show Trump committed crimes. Then on Friday, a federal judge agreed with the special counsel. She ordered Evan Corcoran to comply with the grand jury subpoena for his testimony, and pivotally, she ordered him to hand over a number of records related to what the judge reportedly referred to as Trump's alleged criminal scheme. Those documents would be handwritten notes and invoices and transcriptions of personal audio recordings. Trump's team, not wanting those documents in the hands of the special counsel, for pretty obvious reasons, the legal team representing Trump appealed that ruling. And that dispute is what led to the D.C. Circuit to assign special counsel Jack Smith that all-nighter last night. And so now today, that same appeals court has ruled in Jack Smith's favor. It refused to grant the Trump team's appeal, meaning Friday's ruling piercing Corcoran's attorney-client privilege that can take effect. CNN and CBS are both reporting that Corcoran is set to testify on Friday. The actual legal judgment remains under seal, and NBC News has not yet independently confirmed Friday as the day this will happen. But the key witness to the Mar-a-Lago classified documents obstruction of justice case is now fair game for special counsel Jack Smith. Which begs the question, are we on a watch now for indictments, plural? Joining me now are Laura Jarrett, NBC's senior legal correspondent, and Kyle Chaney, senior legal affairs reporter for Politico. It's great to see you both tonight as we try and understand exactly what is happening in what appears to be a mystery wrapped in enigma, wrapped in something that's under seal.
Well, some of the things are pretty clear.
Yeah, well, first, Laura, I would love your perspective on the unusual timing yesterday, ordering one side to respond by midnight, special counsel has to respond by 6 a.m.
I've never seen that.
How did you interpret that?
That the stakes are very high and that there is something in those materials that the judge, assuming that she reviewed the materials in private, which is called in camera, before she actually ordered them to be turned over. NBC is not yet reporting that, but that's typically how it goes. The judge reviews them and then says, hey, you have to turn them over. Something in those she decided was so high stakes and so important that it needed to be turned over expeditiously. And then the D.C. Court of Appeals agreed with her.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we haven't been able to see what's in those materials. The entire case is under seal, so we don't know what that is. But whatever it is, obviously, Jack Smith cares a lot about it as well, because he went to the trouble of trying to get these materials so that the grand jury can see them, the grand jury that is reviewing this and preparing, you know, to possibly indict.
Do you draw any conclusions about the time frame on all of this, given the rapidity with which the alacrity with which they seem to be moving through some of what would seem to be end stages of this investigation?
I think that it is fair to say you do not go after the former president's attorney until you are really at sort of a critical juncture. It's certainly not the move you would make as your first entry into the case. You would probably do it once you've developed enough facts and evidence to feel like this is really something we need. In fact, you'd have to make that showing to the judge that this is really critical evidence. That's not to say that they are anywhere near close to an indictment. They may not be nearly far as long as perhaps the DA in Manhattan, for instance.
Uh-huh.
But I think it is fair to say that you would do this at an advanced stage in the investigation.
Kyle, I want to ask you, for a moment, prior to Trump announcing that he was running for president, the reporting that we had was, especially in the Washington Post, was that, the DOJ was close to charging decisions in the Mar-a-Lago case last fall. Now, obviously, that didn't come to pass. Special Counsel Jack Smith is appointed to run this. It's now March, months later. But we are, as Laura points out, we are talking about the president's lawyer being subpoenaed, going forward, providing this evidence. I mean, what is your estimation about what else we might expect in terms of witnesses that could be called, in terms of the work that remains on this case, which to the layman seems pretty exhaustive at this point?
Right. Well, and I think just to even put it in a broader perspective, you have what's happening in Manhattan, you have the documents case, and then you have Fulton County, Trump is being investigated for attempting to overturn the election in Georgia. All three of those could be imminent. It's not even just the two we've talked about, but this third one in Fulton County, where indictment could come any day. The DA in Fulton said it's imminent. The charging decisions are imminent there. So it's really remarkable when you think about, and I think it's absolutely right, when you are going to pierce attorney-client privilege, especially on a crime fraud theory, you are pretty much at the end game. Judges don't like to do that. And ever in any circumstances. And so when you have the chief judge at the time agreeing that that's appropriate and the appeals court agreeing with her, it seems like the evidence must be pretty compelling and overwhelming. Now the question is, will Corcoran show on Friday? Will there be some effort to send this to the Supreme Court, which we haven't seen any signals of yet? So there's some reporting, I think, that Trump is not interested in going to the Supreme Court. So this may be that he shows up and he gives them the goods that he has, and an indictment could be fairly forthcoming right after that.
What's your assessment of that, Laura? Because, you know, while the judge ruled that, yes, the evidence has to, Corcoran has to testify, the evidence has to go, the prosecutors can look at the evidence that we're talking about, and we'll get to that in a second. But the appeals process continues, right? Kyle's saying that Trump reportedly doesn't want this to go to the Supreme Court, given how they've handled previously sort of similar things. I mean, what's your estimation about the fight ahead and how much this could be litigated further?
Well, keeping the appeal open can be risky for Smith. If in the event that later down the line a court decides, actually, these documents should not have come into evidence, should not have gone before a jury, and the whole thing gets thrown out, that could be particularly problematic for him. So even if he is allowed and his team are allowed to review these materials, they may not ultimately use them in whatever decision they make about whether or not to go forward, if they were to go forward with an indictment.
Well, let's just talk about the materials, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about notes recordings. From personal audio recordings.
We don't know what that is, but yeah.
We don't know what that is, but, you know, the judge who's examined this material is referring to it as Trump's alleged criminal scheme. I mean, she's putting the word Trump and criminal scheme together after the review of these materials, which may include notes from personal audio recordings.
Well, and what's so weird is usually when you see the crime fraud exception invoked, it's in a case where the lawyer is in some sort of cahoots with the client. In this case, what at least it appears to be is that the judge has suggested that Trump actually misled his own attorneys in some way. Again, the contours of that we're going to have to report out. But as you said in your setup here, we know that the part of the reason Corcoran is so interesting is he drafts what turns out to be a highly misleading statement that the Justice Department receives and relies on. Was that done at his client's suggestion? And if so, how did all of that come together? Those are the kinds of questions Smith is going to try to be drilling down on.
The statement is the sort of centerpiece of the obstruction case, right? Mm-hmm. This notion that the Trump legal team says, you know what, guys,
you got everything.
Yeah. Now, what we know about that statement is Evan Corcoran drafts it, but Christina Bob, a different lawyer, signs it. And I wonder if you're interested in the sort of choreography of the signing of that statement, because it suggests, you know, well, I think their inference is going to be drawn about who knew what in terms of the legality of that statement.
Right. And that's why, you know, one of the questions I've got is Evan Corcoran coming forward willingly? Is he someone who says, I want to tell you what I know, A, to clear my own name and maybe to clear the people who worked with me, and then Trump is intervening to block him, because the sequence of events here suggests that it was Trump who intervened to stop Corcoran from coming forward and to stop him from talking. Now, again, I don't know, because this is all happening in secret, because it's all under seal. You know, we learn bits and pieces here and there. And so it's hard to always judge, like, what are the motivations here? But one of the theories, at least behind why the appeals court moved with such urgency, is because perhaps Corcoran was ready to come say what he knew. And if they didn't step in to sort of adjudicate this, it might have been too late. We saw a very similar situation play out last fall when Mark Short and Greg Jacobs, some aides to Mike Pence, were subpoenaed to testify to the January 6th grand jury. Same, very similar secret process that Trump lost. And the very next day after he lost that process, Mark Short came in and testified. We've seen this movie before in a certain way, and maybe Evan Corcoran has a lot to say.
That's a fascinating theory, Laura, and I wonder what you make of it, that perhaps Evan Corcoran is a cooperative witness And they got to get this material in the prosecutor's hands stat because he wants to come and testify.
We just don't know. There has also been some reporting out there that Beryl Howell actually ordered him to produce all these documents by, you know, X date. And so the idea was the appellate court, in order to make sure that they got out ahead of that ruling, they ordered everything to be done so expeditiously so that they could have a full, you know, sort of airing of their side of this before he was actually ordered to produce the stuff by Beryl Howell. But we just simply don't know, you know. I wish we did. We're working on it. But I think we just don't yet know enough about what Corcoran's level of cooperation is here, if any.
Well, we do have a sense that he's pretty exposed, and we do have reporting that he is still working as a lawyer for Donald Trump, which, Laura, again, I am not a lawyer, but that seems pretty perilous, not only for Evan Corcoran, but also for Donald Trump, because if Evan Corcoran is a potential witness in this case,
he would no longer be able to defend him. I mean,
also, Trump could be accused of witness tampering, couldn't he? I mean, there's just so many levels to how this is legally perilous for all parties involved. Does it surprise you that Evan Corcoran is still involved in legal counsel to Donald Trump on this?
Nothing would surprise me about any of this anymore, given how all the legal machinations in this case go. But I think we have to wait and see how some of this plays out. And again, I think the big question is, how does Smith want to use this material?
Yeah.
Right? Because remember, the bar for getting it, you know, just through a grand jury subpoena is lower than obviously the threshold he would have to make in court to actually prove these charges beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a different threshold. And so I'm curious to see how, if at all, Smith uses the materials that he fought so hard to get.
Yeah. And I will say, we just want to highlight, in addition to the statement that we talked about, it's also this phone call that Trump makes to Corcoran, allegedly, in and around the same time frame that the DOJ is subpoenaing to get their hands on the video footage that then reveals that, yes, indeed, people were moving boxes around Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
The contents of that call are going to be of great interest, well, to all of us, let's be honest, but especially to the Department of Justice as it tries to figure out what, as you point out, it's going to do in this Mar-a-Lago documents case.
Yeah.
Laura, come back. Please, all the time.
This is not going away, that's for sure.
This is not going away. Kyle Chaney, thank you so much for your great reporting. Thank both of you for your time and wisdom and expertise and, you know, walking with us down this strange and winding road. We have a lot to get to this evening, including the role of the National Enquirer in the hush money scheme that may end up making history. That tabloid, if you recall, maybe you don't, also played a role in another national scandal involving a major political figure and an affair and hush money. We'll have more on that when we come back.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
It was the summer of 2004. The presidential election was just around the corner, and everyone was waiting for Democratic candidate John Kerry to choose a running mate. That was when the New York Post got a big scoop and rushed to print this front page story. Kerry's choice, Dem picks Gephardt as VP candidate. Now, John Kerry did not pick Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt to be his running mate. The New York Post got it wrong, sort of the vice presidential version of Dewey defeats Truman. But maybe John Kerry should have listened to the Post prediction that morning, because the man John Kerry did pick to be his running mate that year was this guy, North Carolina Senator John Edwards. And by 2018, John Kerry was telling news outlets that choosing John Edwards was a mistake. Kerry said Edwards didn't measure up as vice presidential candidate because 7 years after Kerry and Edwards lost the 2004 presidential election, John Edwards became America's first national political candidate to be indicted for a scheme to pay hush money to a former mistress in order to cover up an affair.
With his daughter Kate by his side, John Edwards took responsibility for doing wrong, but not for breaking the law.
I did not break the law, and I never, ever thought I was breaking the law.
At issue, almost $1 million provided by two wealthy donors. According to the government, the money was used to hide Edwards' mistress, Riel Hunter, and later their child, while he ran for president. The six-count indictment alleges the payments constituted unlawful campaign contributions and accuses Edwards of soliciting and covering them up, saying he knew that if the affair became public, it would undermine his image as a family man and destroy his candidacy.
No one has ever been charged, either civilly or criminally, with the claims that have been brought against Senator Edwards today.
No one has ever been charged, either civilly or criminally, with the claims that have been brought against Senator Edwards today. As far as national political candidates are concerned, that claim is still true, at least for now. The world is waiting to see if Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg will bring charges against Donald Trump for his own alleged scheme to pay hush money to a former mistress in order to cover up an alleged affair. And the potential case against Trump is remarkably similar to the one brought against John Edwards a decade ago. Both cases involved paying a woman to keep secret an alleged affair during a presidential campaign. And both cases hinge on the idea that the hush money paid to cover up that affair, that money constituted an illegal campaign donation. Those similarities are nearly certain to be in the back of Manhattan DA Bragg's mind right now, because even though John Edwards' political career was effectively ended by the discovery of his affair and his secret love child, the legal case against Edwards proved significantly less damning. In 2012, a jury acquitted Edwards of one campaign finance charge at the center of the government's case against him. The jury deadlocked on five other charges. But because Edwards was found not guilty on that campaign finance charge, the rest of the case started to look a lot shakier, and the prosecution chose not to retry Edwards on those other charges. And now legal experts are warning of similar pitfalls in the potential case against Donald Trump. It is not yet clear, for example, whether or not prosecutors will be able to prove that the alleged hush money payment made to Stormy Daniels, whether that constituted a campaign finance violation. So, how can prosecutors avoid repeating history as they weigh whether to bring these historic charges against a former president? I will ask a former Manhattan prosecutor that very question and a whole lot more coming up next.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
In December 2007, it was the National Enquirer that broke the very first story about a major candidate for president shelling out hush money to cover up an extramarital affair. The candidate was John Edwards, and the National Enquirer reported that his mistress was pregnant. Once the Enquirer broke that first story, it was like a dog with a bone. The paper deployed every tactic it could to keep front pages like these on the newsstands for the better part of a year. In 2010, that coverage earned the tabloid a Pulitzer Prize nomination. So this story was clearly gold for the National Enquirer. And in 2016, the paper had the chance to do it all over again. They had a shot to break the news that a second major candidate for president had shelled out hush money payments to cover up two extramarital trysts. This time, though, the Enquirer decided not to break the story, but to cover it up, because in 2016, the candidate was Donald Trump. And this time, instead, the Wall Street Journal broke the story that Dave Pecker, the chair of the company that publishes The Enquirer, helped catch and kill stories about Trump and his affairs and was involved in hush money payments to Trump's mistresses. Pecker then gave prosecutors the information they used to charge Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, who then implicated Trump himself in the hush money scandal, which brings us to this week. As we wait for a Manhattan grand jury to decide on its recommendation about whether to charge Trump for his role in those hush money payments, we have news that those jurors are preparing to reconvene tomorrow. Reports say jurors might hear from one more witness before they vote. Joining us now is Karen Agnifilo. I'm so sorry, Karen.
All good.
Former chief district attorney for former Manhattan DA Cy Vance. Karen, thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you.
I'll get it right on the, okay, on the outtribe. But like, Karen, you have a wealth of experience in this sort of legal situation, if not this particular case. And I wonder, first and foremost, the kind of back and forth we've seen this weekend, pausing the grand jury, bringing them back, the suggestion of one more witness. There are rumors out there that that one more witness, maybe Michael Cohen, maybe someone else. At the start of the week, Bob Costello, one of the former legal minds that was involved in a lot of this back in the day, came out and really impugned Michael Cohen's character. He's a star witness here, potentially, for the Manhattan DA. Do you think what we could be seeing right now is Alvin Bragg trying to clean up the mess that Bob Costello made at the beginning of the week?
So what's happening is basically a mini trial in the grand jury, which is unusual. Grand jury proceedings are usually bare bones. They're much smaller amount of evidence and time of a trial. There's no opening statement. There's no summations. There's no cross-examination. You're just putting on a bare bones case to get to the over the hurdle of an indictment, which is a much lower standard than at trial when you have to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. But here, you're having a little bit of a mini trial going on because the grand jury heard from a defense witness, Mr. Costello, which the defense had a right to request that.
Yeah.
And the grand jury heard it. And so it's common in a situation like this where you would want to put on rebuttal witnesses, or at least consider putting on rebuttal witnesses if there was some doubt sown or some information given that the prosecution wants to rebut.
And also, it feels like the public is so engaged in every chapter of this, even though, as you point out, this isn't the trial. This is the grand jury proceeding. Right. I wonder if optics matter, too, because Bob Costello was out there speaking at a press availability about Michael Cohen holding up copies of a book that, you know, talks about him and his role as a fixer. Does that matter at all in the eyes of the Manhattan DA?
Well, look, Michael Cohen was known. The Manhattan DA knows who Michael Cohen is, right? They know that he has a conviction for lying to Congress and that he has other criminal convictions and that he's flip-flopped, right? There was a point in time where he said Donald Trump had nothing to do with this, and now he's saying he does. So, you know, you have to corroborate absolutely everything Michael Cohen says.
Yeah.
But Michael Cohen also provides a lot of color for who Donald Trump is. I mean, Donald Trump picked Michael Cohen. Donald Trump used Michael Cohen, and Michael Cohen says he wrote the book on how to do these criminal schemes that lawyers and others are doing with Donald Trump. So that is who Donald Trump picked, is somebody like that. And as a prosecutor, you have to live with whoever it is that the defendant brings in as the witness, as the person in the room who's going to have the evidence. But I think Alvin Bragg had all of that corroboration lined up, knowing that you'd have to corroborate mm-hmm. him. And
he knew who Michael Cohen was.
Exactly.
What Let's talk a little bit about the strength of this case, because we did a fair amount of we treated everyone to the John Edwards history on this, right? How do you see this case as meaningfully different than the Edwards case, for example?
So this case has two legal issues, right? There's A, did it happen? Can you prove it? And, mm-hmm. you know, Michael Cohen has the issues that he has. So you have to corroborate that. And B, does it have, is it legally sound, right? So, and this case has both of those issues, which, you know, in the John Edwards case, I think didn't necessarily have those issues, right? I mean, the John Edwards case, you know, it was much more about the facts and whether that was for a campaign violation and yeah. whether or not to, you know, an inappropriate campaign violation. Here, it has a similar legal issue, but it also has an additional legal issue because this is a state court prosecution, mm-hmm. and there's questions about whether a federal campaign counts as the crime that bumps falsifying a business record from a misdemeanor to a felony. Right.
I mean, so everyone said, like, because it's a two-tiered process, if you will, to escalate it to a felony. People have supposed, they've ideated that the campaign finance piece is what elevates it to a felony. There are other potential crimes that could be cited that would elevate it to a felony, are there not, yeah. beyond the campaign finance
yes,
violation?
Yes, there absolutely are. And I use an analogy of a burglary. So if a burglary is a trespass, right, you knowingly enter and remain unlawfully somewhere, that's a trespass, that's a misdemeanor. What turns a trespass into a burglary is if when you go in, you had the intent to commit a crime while you're in there. You don't necessarily have to prove the crime. They don't necessarily have to even right. commit, you know, you don't even know what crime they were going to commit. You just know that it wasn't just to take a nap on your couch, right? He had yeah. a knife or whatever, you know? And so that's similar here, I think. I think here you're going to look at different facts. Like if this was proper, why didn't they record it as a, you know, paying? Because it's not illegal to do a hush money payment, right? So why did they have to record it as a legal retainer? And Donald Trump is out there saying, well, he didn't want Melania to know. But I would argue that I don't think she's checking the books and records of the Trump organization.
I think that's
right?
a good hazard
so,
guess.
Right. And then why did they structure the payments? There were 11 different payments. Why did they structure them over time if they weren't trying to hide it, right? So, and what was going on 2 weeks later? He was elected. Mm-hmm. It was the election. So I think you can make a very strong argument that this was for the purpose of committing a crime. And it could be one of several crimes.
Yeah. He wasn't just taking a nap on the couch.
Exactly.
Last question for you. In terms of why the feds did not pursue this when it was kind of in their hands. You know, Bill Barr was the attorney general at the time, but Merrick Garland is now the AG. Do you have a thought about why this administration, why this Department of Justice did not more, you know, fully pursue the hush money case?
Yeah, well, at the time that Michael Cohen pled guilty in 2018 and they talked about individual one, the Justice Department then, and this was Bill Barr's Justice Department, you know, they found that individual one, who was Donald Trump, actually participated in this, right? But he was president at the time, and mm-hmm. nobody's going to bring a case against a sitting president. That just wasn't going to happen. Why Merrick Garland didn't pick it up afterward, I mean, I would argue that he had 1,000 people that he had to prosecute as a result
for January 6th.
For January 6th and a lot of other issues involving Donald Trump, and this just sort of fell by the wayside. But that's just a guess, but that's what I think. I mean, they've been so busy with the Mar-a-Lago documents case, with January 6th insurrection, and all of those prosecutions.
Yeah, it's an understatement to say that the DOJ has been busy. Karen Agnifilo, thank you so much for your expertise and your wisdom. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We have much more ahead tonight. There is yet another trial looming, a different one, not the ones we've been talking about. Another trial looming for former President Trump, this one over serious allegations dating back to the 1990s. Woo! Plus, a New York Times report takes us inside Trump world as the former president braces for indictment. We will get the scoop on what reporters are describing as Trump's magical thinking. That is next. Donald Trump may be facing a looming criminal indictment, which is both historic, but also in the most Trumpy way possible, it is business as usual. That's mostly because talk of a possible indictment has found the former president spending his time doing what he does best, fundraising off the drama. Trump's campaign tells Fox News that he's raised $1.5 million in the 3 days after he went on Truth Social to issue a rant about his possible arrest and call for protests. NBC News has not confirmed that fundraising number. Trump's most ardent supporters are also latching on to Trump's potential indictment in a way that only Trump supporters would. A conservative lawyer who represents several January 6 defendants tweeted this weekend, "President Trump will be arrested during Lent, a time of suffering and purification for the followers of Jesus Christ. As Christ was crucified and then rose again on the third day, so too will @real Donald Trump." Subtle. Meanwhile, the New York Times characterized Trump's current behavior and state of mind this way. "Mr. Trump has been both invigorated and angered by the prospect of being arrested, according to those who have spoken with him, and he has also entertained a certain amount of magical thinking." Joining us now is the lead author on that story, Michael Bender, political correspondent for the New York Times, along with the great Matthew Dowd, chief strategist for the Bush-Cheney 2004 presidential campaign and an MSNBC political analyst. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. And I'll start with you, Michael, about the magical thinking. If you could illustrate to us or just retell, what kind of magical thinking are we talking about in Trump world as it pertains to this indictment?
Yeah, there's a couple things here. One is we've talked to several people who have spoken to the former president who say he is he's become fixated on an idea of a perp walk. This is the tradition that detectives and police reporters in New York City are very familiar with, of the newly arrested being walked past a gaggle of reporters and news cameras. And Trump has been kind of captivated by this idea, talking to people about, if he's going to have a perp walk and whether he would smile for the cameras, how that kind of thing might, play with the American public. You know, has left several people thinking that that he sees this as kind of a fun thing to do, and certainly an opportunity here to make a political statement. What he's sort of thinking here is anything to project strength and confidence. He doesn't want to be seen as slinking away in shame if he's arrested. But the truth is, he probably most likely will not have a perp walk. That sort of thing will be, if he is arrested, that sort of thing will be negotiated by law enforcement and Secret Service, who will most likely want to avoid a massive scene. And the other kind of wild thing here is that he's been launched a very big pressure campaign. You showed some of those really over-the-top campaign requests and contribution requests. He's gone on a tirade attacking the Manhattan DA, and some Trump aides have convinced themselves and have spoken to the former president about this, that pressure campaign may actually be having an effect, and that the Manhattan DA may walk away from an indictment, may decide not to indict the former president because of the pressure campaign Trump is weighing. We've seen this before. The Trump White House had convinced themselves that a Democratic House run by Nancy Pelosi might not indict him, that they thought at the time that they had turned some Democratic votes and that vote would go down. We know that didn't happen the first time or the second time. It's unlikely that his pressure campaign is having any effect on the Manhattan District Attorney's Office now either.
Yeah, my head is spinning with all the things you just said, Michael. Matthew, let's first unpack the twilight zone in which that sort of Trump land exists, that a perp walk, Matthew, could be seen as a sign of strength. How do you see a perp walk in this day and age as it pertains to Donald Trump?
Well, Alex, what's funny about it is I think it's a reflection of how they think about their supporters. They think about their supporters and the idea that having a perp walk of Donald Trump would actually benefit him. And that actually says to me all you need to know about what they think about their supporters, which is that they'll never hold him accountable. They don't care what he does. He's free to run his criminality or whatever. That's what they think. So they can do anything and get away with it. The sad news is, my fear is that at least in the short term among Republican primary voters, his base, he would actually, I think, benefit of that. He may get an initial lift of that because he's going to make it seem like you think I'm being persecuted, but it's really you're being persecuted. Mm-hmm. You're the real victim. They're going after your culture, your life, your all of that. I think what if you really gave truth serum to Republican leaders, even those that have been in defense of him, like Kevin McCarthy, what they would like to see is they would like to see they support Donald Trump. Donald Trump sees their loyalty, and Donald Trump is never the nominee of the party, because I think they know deep in their hearts that if he makes it through the primary, having an indicted Donald Trump going into a general election is the worst possible thing for them in keeping the House.
I do wonder, though, Matthew, like when we talk about the support of his followers, if you think fundraising is at all indicative of ardor, of enthusiasm, because, you know, let's remember, in the 8 weeks after Trump says he didn't lose the 2020 election, he raised $255 million, right? His campaign is saying it raised 1.5 since his rant on Saturday. Now, the stakes are arguably just as high. He's like potentially going to get perp walked and arrested here. The numbers are decidedly a lot lower this time around as you talk about the martyr complex. Do you think that that is indicative of anything, or is that just, how do you read that?
Well, I've tried to speak out against this for the last 10 years. I think the metric of fundraising and the metric of rallies, and I pair them together, are no longer applicable to how actually voters think, how the voters who are going to decide these elections really feel, and what it really manifests itself. Nearly every single Trump-endorsed candidate in 2022 raised a ton of grassroots money. And I had all kinds of, just Carrie Lake's a perfect example. She raised a ton of money. She had all these rallies, screaming, yelling people at the rallies, and she lost. And so I think we should start abandoning that metric as a metric that says this person is strong, this person is powerful, this person is demonstrating political support. Because time and time again, I mean, Sarah Palin used to draw huge rallies, much bigger than Barack Obama. And that ended up being a negative on the ticket. So I don't think it's indicative of a base support. It's not indicative of what could happen in a general election.
Fair point. Michael, I mean, I know Trump is embracing certain aspects of this potential indictment, but your reporting indicates that there is actual fear in Trump land. And I wonder if you could take us back to the fear that he felt, I think it was in 1973, about being arrested after the first criminal investigation into the DOJ's investigation into the Trump and Trump and their potential suit for housing discrimination.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there a couple things are true here. One is Trump is trying to move this legal fight in Manhattan onto a political battlefield so that he can find a way to leverage this for his campaign moving forward and to mitigate as much damage as possible. But let's not kid ourselves here. Donald Trump does not want to be arrested. He does not want to be indicted. We see that in social media. You see his some of his posts on his social media website, all capital letters to the Manhattan DA, do the right thing. He does not want an indictment on his record. And he's always had a certain fear of being arrested. I mean, it sort of sounds silly to say that out loud, but it's true. I mean, he has he's cultivated a lot of relationships with that dynamic underpinning it. He folks who may be able to help him if he got to the point of an arrest or an indictment, he made sure to keep them close. I would like to just jump back. You were asking about the fundraising. I do think that from what I've seen in some polling lately, I mean, Trump's base doesn't seem to be going anywhere. But the biggest question I think Republican voters are going to face in this Republican primary is whether they think Trump can win in November of 2024, if they think he can beat Biden. He's got to bring back moderate Republicans and independents who have abandoned him for three consecutive election cycles at this point. We've seen him steady his polling in the last few months, but that's because in large part he's been playing to smaller crowds. He's been answering questions. He's doing more traditional type of campaigning, not 100% of the time, but more than he used to. His response to this indictment is exactly the kind of thing that that has long turned off moderate Republicans and independents from Trump, and I think that's the thing to watch. The effect that this could have moving forward.
All right. I just want to say for the record, I don't know a lot of people that have an ongoing and generalized fear about being arrested. So that's interesting psychology right there. We're going to leave it there. Fair. Matthew Dowd and Michael Bender, really appreciate your time. Thank you both for your wisdom this evening. That does it for us tonight. We will see you again tomorrow.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.